Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Kay Puttock, together with my co-host, Belinda Merritt. Hello, Belinda, and welcome to you, the listener.
Hello, Kay, and hello, everyone else. But before we get into the details of today's program, we'd like to update you all on a recent story that we aired. A few weeks back, we broadcast excerpts from a forum that was held in Ames on legislation that would allow all people, regardless of documentation status, to legally obtain an Iowa driver's license. We heard three different perspectives on that bill, all of which were supportive of it, including one from the Story County Sheriff. Well, the update is that Senator Sodders introduced the bill in the Judiciary Committee. It is State Senate Bill, or SSB, 1092. If you want to hear our original story about driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, you can listen to it on the KHOI website. It was broadcast on January 23rd.
And for today, we've got another interesting lineup for you. We start with an interview with Commander Jason Tuttle of the Ames Police, talking about the police department's crisis intervention team. This is the team that responds to families or individuals who might call the police because they or a family member is facing a crisis caused by an episode of mental illness. Recently, the team has undergone some changes, including the retirement of one of its major heroes, Detective Jerry Spencer, who has been such an asset to the team until his retirement. But Belinda, in the interest of full disclosure, didn't you tell me that Detective Jerry Spencer is your brother-in-law?
Yes, he is.
But actually, I did the interview, which is pre-recorded, and I don't think you even knew about it till it was over, did you?
No, I didn't.
So, though Commander Tuttle has some very nice things to say about your brother-in-law, you're not directly involved in that interview at all.
No, I'm not. But today we continue the mental health theme with our next interview with representatives of the nonprofit organization Community and Family Resources, or CFR. Since 1968, they have been helping people learn healthy behaviors, prevent addictions, and also to recover from them. They deal with all kinds of addictions, alcohol, substance abuse, tobacco or nicotine, and gambling addiction. And they have some wonderful success stories, too.
Yes, and because a special Humane Lobby Day is coming up very soon in the state capitol, our final interview is with Mary LaHaye of Iowa Friends of Companion Animals, and she's also from Iowa Voters for Companion Animals. In addition to alerting people to the lobby day, Mary and I discuss a bill that will be coming up in the state legislature. It's a bill dealing with the oversight and regulation of large-scale commercial dog breeding facilities. There are a huge number of commercial dog breeders in Iowa, so this is a very important issue for us. And of course, since it's Friday, Belinda, we'll end up with your roundup of the local live music scene.
That's right. But let's get started with our first interview with Police Commander Jason Tuttle.
Our guest is Commander Jason Tuttle of the Ames Police Department, and he's come to talk to us about mental health issues that the police deal with. And this interview's been sparked by the retirement of Detective Jerry Spencer, recently retired and had a special place with the Mental Health Crisis Intervention Team, I believe, with the police. Well, welcome, Commander Tuttle.
Thanks for having me.
And would you like to tell us about exactly what Detective Jerry Spencer did and why you'll miss him?
Sure. Actually, this is Jerry's second retirement from the police department, so we're sorry we had to lose him, but he's off to better things now. But Jerry previously was a detective for our department, and while he was doing that job, he had an interest in helping people with mental illnesses. And so when he retired from his detective division several years ago, we hired him as a part-time mental health advocate for our department. Jerry worked 20 hours per week, and so his primary role would be to provide information to some of the mental health service providers here in Ames. So every morning, Jerry would go through our log and go through our calls for service and see if there were calls in there that would be beneficial for us to send out to some of the clinicians and other providers in Ames. And then he would often also directly call some of those people with mental illnesses and provide them some resources to help them get help. some of the people, he would take to some of their appointments. If they didn't have a vehicle to get there, he would assist them in getting to their appointments. He would also be a liaison for family members when they would call us and they may not know what to do with a loved one who has a mental illness. So Jerry was just a great resource that we had at our department. And he also fostered a lot of very positive relationships with some of our local coalitions. NAMI is one of the coalitions.
National Alliance of Mental Illness.
Correct.
NAMI.
Correct. Ireley Ball is another service provider in town that we work with frequently. He worked also with the Story County Mental Health Task Force. And so Jerry developed a lot of great relationships that we're going to continue to, those people we're going to continue to work with.
Yeah, going back to these calls, I understand that the police department can get hundreds of calls, sometimes from the same individual. And that was a surprise to me, that someone that's in some kind of crisis would call the police rather than, say, I don't know, a suicide hotline or, I don't know, one of these hotlines. But apparently they call the police often.
Yeah, I would say we do get phone calls from family members and other loved ones who are worried about someone in a time of crisis, but we often get phone calls from repeat customers. They'll call us. Again, last week we had a person who called us over 80 times in over several night period because they were having a manic episode and they just wanted to talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, our officers often have other emergency phone calls, high priority calls. In this situation, the person wasn't in a, his condition wasn't that he needed to be hospitalized. He wanted someone to talk to. And so Jerry often filled that gap for us. When he would come in the morning, he would follow up with those people. And again, he may go to their house and visit with them, or he may call them on the phone and try to work out, try to help them with the problem that they're having.
And the calls, as you said, they're often from people with mental illness who are not necessarily in crisis, but as you say, want someone to talk to, often from family members,
right,
having to deal with someone in their house and maybe want to get them to hospital and they can't do it by themselves.
Right, right. That was an call that we got often. And Jerry would, many times he would help the family get a court order to have their loved one committed to have that emergency evaluation at the hospital. And so he, again, he knew where to send them to get that paperwork. Sometimes he would go to the clerk's office where they would fill out that paperwork before a judge. And generally it takes two people to do that know the person or know their condition. And so he would assist the families in that way.
Being committed nowadays is not what it used to be when I was young, like put him in place and throw away the key. It's
right.
It's for a few days.
Right.
While
it's just to get them over that crisis situation that they're in. They're not, generally we call it a 48-hour hold.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally, we would take them to the emergency room here at Mary Greeley and someone from the behavioral health unit will come down and evaluate that person. And then if they believe they should be held against their will, they can get a judge's order to have them held for that 48-hour time period. Or if the person wants to stay there voluntarily.
Yeah, they'll often
right,
agree
and so,
to stay.
And they'll take them and then at that point and help them with that crisis situation that they're going through. And then that also helps that person get linked up for services, hopefully once they get released, get them hooked up with a provider or a counselor. And so again, that's why Jerry's position was so critical to our department, and still is. He would forward that information out to those providers so they would have a snapshot of what's going on maybe after hours, things that they wouldn't see maybe when they're visiting with that consumer.
Right. While we're on the topic of sort of what you might call emergency calls, say a family member calls someone, and I was speaking to a woman the other day who her son is autistic and has also got a mental health problem, and it's not uncommon for him to make a hole in the wall and things like that.
Right.
Now, so someone like that calls the police. It might be in the middle of the night, say, and there's a cop car, maybe two cop cars outside the house with lights going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the point of view of the family member or the person that's made that call, I believe there are certain things that they can do to help the situation, like go outside and meet the police officers, for example, and then go back in with them so they know what they're getting into.
Right, exactly. When someone in a situation like that, I would really encourage people to come out again and meet us and tell us right away, my son has autism, the bright lights may affect him. If you still have those on your squad car when you pull up, can you turn those off? And I would say majority of the time we're going to say no problem. When we get to those calls, we want to de-escalate the situation.
Right.
We don't want to have to put our hands on someone if we don't have to. We want to try to calm the environment so that we can talk to that person and get them, whether it's the help they need or just to get them calmed down for the night. But there are things like that that can happen that we really need to know about, whether they tell the dispatcher when they call in. But I also like them to tell the officer again, because again, sometimes our dispatchers have so many things going on in
there.
They can't pass on every single thing that comes through over the phone. So again, it would be very helpful when we show up. And if they know some things, specific strategies that do help calm their loved one down, that they let us know what those things are, because every person, right, you know, has different things that can help them.
Mm-hmm. Also, people might not know, say you've been able to get the person to persuade the person to get to an ambulance. A family member can go with them in the ambulance, which might help to keep them calm too.
Right, right. And sometimes we'll transport them in our squad cars, and we really have to evaluate each situation when those things do come up. If they have some type of injuries, if someone's cut their arm or if there's been some other injury to the body, then we're certainly going to call an ambulance. But if we go there and there aren't any maybe physical injuries that we see, we may offer to transport them in our squad car. If the family member thinks that it'd be better if they went with them, we could do that. We've also followed people to the hospital. We're also careful with that.
No, they go in their own car.
Right. But because we've had people jump out of cars then when that happens, and then we have less control of the situation. So we need to get some of that background information so we know, has this happened before? How did they react when we responded? Are they scared of officers? You know, some people, obviously by the way we look when we show up, we have all this stuff on our belt. And so we do have strategies that we can utilize in those situations to help, again, de-escalate the situation.
Okay. I'm sure that will be very helpful to people, this kind of information. I believe the crisis intervention team has changed recently because, well, why don't you explain why it's changed?
Sure. Yeah, back in the 2000s, we had a specific team, the crisis intervention team, that received 40 hours of training. There were multiple people from several of the departments in Story County that went through this training, and Dr. Gene Deisinger coordinated that training whenever he was here, and he was a captain with the Iowa State Police Department. And so we were able to—
And he was also a doctorate of psychology.
Correct, correct.
Or had a doctorate of psychology.
Correct.
So
we would utilize our team members when we responded to a call where someone needed assistance with a mental health issue. And that could be someone that was on duty that we could pull from another area of town and come to help us with a call. We could call a person from another agency and they would respond and help us with the situation. We could also call people out from their homes. Unfortunately, when Dr. Deisinger left, we didn't have anybody with that level of expertise and training to continue to coordinate that team. So unfortunately, the team concept really lax at that point. We still have officers that receive mental health training. It's not as much of a coordinated team effort from multi-agencies. We still can respond to those calls now, but it was very beneficial when we had other people.
A specialized team.
Right. Other specialized people with training that could respond and provide resources.
So the training that the team used to have, now this was a team of how many people?
Well, I would say we probably had 15 to 20 people in the county that
were
trained.
And they would have a specialized training with different experts coming to talk to them. For how many hours was that training?
It was 40 hours. And I think I went through the training in 2002 or 2003. And I think just looking back, the thing that I learned the most from the training is when we had a family that had a loved one that had mental illness come in and talk to us about their view of the police and the things that had happened to them in the past. So that was powerful for us. Because unless you have a loved one that deals with these issues, you just can't understand what they go through. And so that was one of the most powerful things that I got from that training, was hearing what the family, they'd had good interactions with the police and they'd had some bad ones. Mm-hmm. And so hearing how we could respond to that situation, the small things that we could do to prevent it from escalating, it was just very powerful to me.
Okay, so this was a 40-hour training, but when Dr. Deisinger left, this has sort of gone by the wayside.
Yes, it did. Again, we've had training since then, smaller doses of training. Last week, all of our certified officers for our city police department had to go through 4 hours of mental health training. We had Dr. Phil Ashman from Des Moines come up and teach us for 3 days. And so we got all of our officers through that training. Now we're looking into the future. What's our next step? Mm-hmm. Part of that process is going to be going back to NAMI, Ireley Ball, some of these other service agencies and groups in town, and also getting some input from them on that. We need to go to them and get some feedback from them and see what they think we should be doing in the future as well.
So do you think you'll be able to reform the crisis intervention team the way it used to be and maybe even better?
Right. That would be our ultimate goal. If you look around the nation right now, a lot of the police departments are talking about this very issue. Mm-hmm. How do we form these teams? How do we make them effective for our communities? We'll be having follow-up conversations with our chief about that in the coming months to determine what our next steps are going to be. I just want to clarify, there's a myth out there that some people that have mental illness are violent when they come into some of these crisis episodes. And that really is a myth. We really want people to know that persons with mental illness by the research, are no more likely to be violent than the general population. We want people to understand that because someone has a mental illness doesn't make them a violent person. It's a myth, and it's something that we want people to understand so that they're not afraid to help people that have these issues. And so it's just very important that they know that.
And I realize that Detective Spencer, it was a part-time position that he was doing, but will you be rehiring someone?
We will. I'm actually in the recruitment phase of that right now. We will be setting up interviews in the next couple of weeks for some of our top candidates, we believe, from that position. The posting's already closed for that, so we have the applications, and we're going through those to see who we should invite in for those interviews. And so during that time, we're going to try to pick the person that best is going to do the best at that position to help represent our community.
And will that be a full-time position? Or?
No, it'll still be the 20-hour per week. Mm-hmm. And so we were unique in the past when we had Jerry because he had the police department experience to bring to that position. So the person that we're going to hire for this opening now isn't going to be somebody from within the police department. So we have to make sure that they're a good fit. They have some experience with law enforcement, not necessarily a police officer position, you know, but someone who has that experience in dealing with law enforcement, but also has a heavy dose of experience in dealing with people that have mental illnesses.
Right. Well, good luck with the search, and certainly I think Ames has reason to be proud of the work done by the crisis intervention team in the past, and let's hope it can continue.
Definitely, definitely. I thank you for helping us get the word out on this too, because our ultimate goal again is to provide the best service we can to people that have some of these mental health issues. I can tell you've been on calls that you just see the family members are so upset because they don't know what to do. And we want to be able to respond and help them and help the person get the help from professionals to help them get through that crisis situation they're in. One thing I would say is we don't ever want you to be afraid to call the police. We can respond and try to provide, again, resources to you. It may just be calling us and saying, what are my options? It could be having us respond directly to that loved one's residence. We have this base level of training that we've just provided to our officers. And again, we don't want people to be afraid to call us. We have services here in town as well. Our officers generally have some of those resources, and they know who to forward those people to. So, again, we want to do the best that we can when we respond to those calls, and so don't be afraid to call us.
Well, I've been talking to Commander Jason Tuttle of the Ames Police Department about the retirement of Detective Jerry Spencer and the crisis intervention team that works with people in the area with mental illness. Thank you so much, Commander Tuttle, for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Well, Belinda, let's hope the police department can find a worthy replacement for Detective Spencer. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we'll be continuing the theme of mental health. In this next interview, I had the opportunity to talk with Michelle De La Riva, the executive director of the nonprofit organization Community and Family Resources, or CFR. CFR is mainly concerned with different kinds of addictions, which it both treats after they occur and also deals with proactively by teaching healthy behaviors. In this interview, you'll also hear the voice of Sally Carnes, the operations director of CFR. We covered a lot of ground in this interview, so let's start listening by plunging at the deep end. As this clip begins, I'm asking Michelle De La Riva about the organization's residential programs for people with serious addictions. Now, I noticed when I was looking at your website that you have inpatient services as well,
yes.
Inpatient and outpatient.
Yes.
And as far as I could make out, there's different kinds of inpatient services.
Correct. In our residential programs, we have several different levels of care. When clients come in, typically they are provided with an evaluation, which is about a 1-hour assessment, where we ask a variety of questions and then determine what level they will attend. Our residential program is offered in Fort Dodge, which is where one of our main campuses are. It's for ages 18 and over. It's a 24-hour program. People stay anywhere from 21 to 30 days, depending on what their particular issues are and if they have any co-occurring disorders. So if they have like mental health issues along with substance use or gambling,
which often happens,
which often does happen.
Yes.
So they'll start there.
So then, when they're dealing with problems of withdrawal symptoms, that's where they'll be.
We also have a detoxification program. Folks that come in that need detoxification typically need specialized care, which is provided by our 24/7 nursing staff. People who are detoxing can sometimes have seizures, which is obviously very dangerous, right. Depending on, you know, how much they've used.
And they might have them at any time in the middle of the night or any
correct,
time. Yes.
Correct. Seizures is the most common thing that will happen when you're withdrawing from alcohol. And we oftentimes have people coming in that are drinking excessive amounts of alcohol. Seizures can occur anytime within the first 14 days of withdrawal. So it's one of those things that we really monitor.
I didn't even think of this before until mm-hmm. you started talking. Is there any problems with violence and so when people are going through withdrawal and detoxification?
In our facility, it's rare that anyone will become violent. I think that sometimes people see that on like television shows.
Right.
That, you know, people that are severely intoxicated will be violent. But typically by the time that they come into our program.
By the time they've decided they want treatment.
They want treatment. Right. Yeah. The worst thing that happens is they may start the detox program, which does include a lot of sleeping, and then they determine the next day that they no longer want to be there, and they will leave, which we do allow. We certainly are not a locked facility. We certainly give them the pros and cons of their decision, and some of them do choose to leave the facility.
And the other treatment facilities, that's for when they're past the detox stage.
Correct. We but also have
to help them maintain sobriety. Or?
Yeah. One of the programs that we have that is a really specialized program that we're quite proud of is our Recovery House program. So after someone has completed the residential program, they can go into our Recovery House program, which is basically like community living. So here in Ames, it'd probably look dorm style.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 guys. So it's a men's program mm-hmm. living together in one great big house. Other than there's no drinking and drug use, so other than that, it looks just like the fraternities.
Uh-huh.
and they have a case manager that checks in with them every day, does treatment groups, helps them find jobs. Many of them get connected with AA, NA, or GA, which is Gambling mm-hmm. Anonymous group.
And how about meals? Do they cook for themselves and cooperate in that way? And
they
so
cook
on?
For themselves. Usually they do group meals.
Mm-hmm.
So they have one person who's designated to be the cook for the week. So okay. It's really a great
so
program.
So that sounds if it's very therapeutic on lots of levels.
Yes.
Because it helps people to get along with one another and
yep.
so on.
They learn lots of different life skills too. So,
this is
you know,
Sally.
Yep. Taking,
thank you.
Taking care of, you know, the household duties, the snow and the lawn removal, getting hooked up with community resources. They really are learning to sort of rebuild their lives independent of whatever substance they used to rely on in the past.
Right. Yeah. And I noticed also, thinking of, you know, being therapeutic on lots of levels, I noticed you've got one of your programs is called Dialectical Behavior Therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at that and I thought that would be useful for anyone.
Absolutely.
Like handling stress, teaching mindfulness, what else? Distress tolerance. And interpersonal effectiveness. Now, that mm-hmm. would be so, mm-hmm. so helpful for everybody.
Yes. We actually, most of our therapists and counselors are trained in DBT, which is the dialectical uh-huh. behavioral therapy skills. Because we do find that folks that who are using substances tend to not have that emotional regulation. So that's what
right.
we're starting to teach them.
Right. So is there a cause and effect there? In other words, because they lack these skills, that's why they began drinking maybe, or there's not enough data to know that?
I don't think that's necessarily true. A lot of people who start drinking and using that end up in our residential programs start using at a very young age, even younger than the age of 15,
mm-hmm.
which when you're a teenager is when you really start learning a lot of those skills, like how to manage your emotions effectively, how to communicate. When people don't have the opportunity to practice those
right.
skills, and they're using, which does help to manage your emotions in the short run, they just never get a chance to learn it. But we also use it with our therapy clients here in Ames,
mm-hmm.
Even those who haven't had substance use
right.
issues.
Right. So yeah. You have general mental health services, too, and that would be
mm-hmm.
part of that, presumably.
Yep.
You mentioned helping people find jobs and so on, okay. job searching. So I presume that is necessary because when people have had a serious addiction problem, they've probably dropped out of the employment market.
Yes. Sometimes they have gotten to a position where they haven't been even seeking work or they haven't worked for several years, or perhaps some of the jobs they're interested in requires drug testing and they haven't been able to pass the drug screen or a license. We certainly have treatment for those who have OWIs.
Right.
And provide education program for that as well. So when you're not, when you don't have a license, that really does limit the type of job you can
have. Oh, of course, yes. Okay. Yep. Now, talking about co-occurring disorders and how common they are, if people have mental illness, they often have some kind of addiction problem also, substance abuse problem. Mm-hmm. And is there a cause and effect there? Because I know in NAMI they sort of say that it's a sort of self-treatment. They're trying to treat themselves with alcohol or drugs. Treat the symptoms of their mental illness.
Yeah. When you're talking about NAMI, NAMI typically works with folks who have chronic mental illness.
Right.
Chronic mental illness and smoking absolutely have a direct correlation. I want to say like 90% of people with a chronic mental illness also smoke.
Mm-hmm.
I think the correlation for those who have mental illness and a substance use disorder is more around 60 to 70%.
But that's pretty
high. But it's fairly high.
That's pretty high.
And there is that correlation. I've worked with young people before. One of my first clients when I moved here to Iowa was a young man who was 20 who started hearing voices when he was in high school, but wasn't quite certain what was going on. So he did start using marijuana and then methamphetamines. What really brought him into treatment was the methamphetamines. And then during the course of working with him, we realized that he's hearing voices and he's schizophrenic.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So really working with his family to kind of educate them on what was going on with him, helping him to have a good understanding, which is, you know, a devastating illness. Sometimes for him, he was just terrified, you know, when he was using, at least he had some control,
mm-hmm.
or at least he felt like he had control.
Because he brought it on something.
Right, because he had the ability to use and then kind of block out the voices. Of course, we certainly worked with a psychiatrist to help with medications that then helped to quiet those voices so he could move on, get a job and be more effective. But, I mean, that's kind of how it happened for him, is that he started using because something strange was going on with him.
Well, that's a sort of success story right there. And that brings me to one of my questions, which, do you have any particularly striking success stories? I realize you can't talk about personalities here, but.
2 years ago, we had a gentleman that had come through our program who had been in prison primarily for substance use and distribution of methamphetamines. And when he returned from prison, he started at our recovery house program. He had two children that he had not seen for 5 years. Their mother was an addict, and he was able to work with Department of Human Services, go through their parenting program, stay sober, and he actually gained custody of those two children.
Well, that is a huge success.
It was huge.
Yes.
And he is still successful to this day. Mm-hmm. He's one of the clients that we certainly continue to check up with, but it's unusual for fathers to have custody of their children. But for a father in that situation, to have custody was a huge battle. I know our recovery house manager really had to advocate for him. It felt like he had to do everything under the sun to get those kids. And we know that children really do very well when they're with a parent.
Of course, yes.
You know, so it was a huge success for us. And you do see, that's just one that popped into my mind when you asked. Because it was just so hard.
And that's one of many similar stories.
Yeah.
I noticed you have tobacco addiction, too. Now, I have read, I don't know how accurate this is, that this is the most difficult addiction. Someone said it's harder than heroin to get off tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you've got any successes with that. My father actually just quit cold turkey and never went back to it when he was 40.
Really?
But that is pretty rare, I think.
I believe that's pretty rare. With nicotine addiction, part of it is that the tobacco companies are pretty smart with their products and with marketing and packaging. So what they do with each actual dosage or cigarette, they put enough nicotine to kind of get somebody through the craving and withdrawal within an hour. So you notice there's 20 cigarettes in the pack. So they, on average, want a smoker to be a pack a day.
It's awful.
Could be awful. In marketing, it works.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So as far as success for nicotine addiction, that one is one of the more difficult ones because of that cycle of craving and withdrawal and craving and withdrawal, that it is so quick that it's difficult for someone to do something different in that short period of time. We certainly do have clients that have quit smoking. Typically, those are ones that really have a good treatment plan. They use the nicotine replacement patches, but there is also that relapse is probably higher than any other drug.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a difficult one. If your dad quit on his own.
He did, yeah.
That's pretty
yeah,
big.
So I may have a false picture of how easy it is, yeah. Now, I notice you have educational proactive programs where you educate, said from starting from preschool through college.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to talk about that, either of you?
Our prevention department has several different types of programs. Our comprehensive prevention is probably what you're asking about, where we have programs for all ages. Typical types of programs are school-based programs where we'll go in, and one of the programs is called Too Good for Drugs. It's very educational, fun. Our prevention staff really want to make the learning a fun way to learn. And we also have our Prime for Life program, which is an education program for those who have an OWI. So it's the Drinkers Drivers program. It's a 12-hour opportunity.
So this is people who've already got into trouble.
It's after they've already gotten into some trouble. We also have a free program here in Ames, which is a drug education program that's offered on Thursday nights that anyone can come in. And we talk about the basics of addiction. We talk about a little bit about the family roles and codependency. So if anyone were concerned or about a family member or themselves, they could come in and get some education. We talk a little bit about the brain chemistry. So it's a 4-week program. As far as our comprehensive, we do so many different things. We go out into workplaces and do education for the supervisors on signs and symptoms of drug use, for the actual people that are employed there. We also will look at what are some of the signs and symptoms and how do you know when maybe the substance use is becoming a problem? Like how
do you intervene? Oneself or
for oneself or even for coworkers. So it's primarily just education on what does one drink look like? If you ask the average person on the street, what is a drink? What do
five
you think
ounces.
They'd say?
Well, I know women are not meant to drink more than 5 ounces of wine a day. But, you know, when I pour my 5 ounces, I don't exactly measure it. So
there you go. So you actually have a pretty good idea of what a
but
drink
a beer,
is.
But a beer would be like one beer, I guess. Well,
like
for men, it's
12
two.
Ounce.
Yeah.
So really it depends.
But of course, there's different sizes now. They have these huge, giant beers.
Yes. So I think that's part of it is that people aren't even aware of how much they're actually drinking. So
right.
Part of the education is getting out there to say is, what is a drink? What does it look like? You're saying, well, for women, 1 glass of wine a day.
5 ounce glass.
5 ounce glass is okay. That may or may not be the case. But usually they really want to look at 3 ounces.
3 ounces.
They might want to have a smaller glass. And they also talk about binge drinking.
Now, when you say 3 ounces, is that...
That is considered a drink.
So 5 ounces is... I thought that was the amount that helps your heart but doesn't give you cancer. I mean, that's basically what I'd read.
You could also have grape juice. Doesn't have to be wine. Yes.
Yeah. Well, of course one could. Yes, yes.
One could. There's lots of different things, I think, that are out in the media that talk about, you know, how much is too much and they don't really necessarily give out great advice. If you ask the Iowa State students, they... would definitely have a different answer. So we do have programs on just teaching people how to drink wisely if they choose to drink and they're over the age of 21. We just currently did a program for the Iowa State football team on a variety of different topics on alcohol use and substances. I think they also wanted to talk about sex addiction. That was an interesting hour for that. Variety of things, depending on the age group and what people are asking for. So if someone was particularly interested in a certain topic, the comprehensive team can actually go out and provide that for your agency or group.
How about help for family members of people who have various addictions and so on?
Mm-hmm. Anyone that would like to come in to discuss that type of situation certainly can come in and there is treatment provided. It's typically In the old times, I think we called it codependency treatment. But really what we do right now is more of education, teaching folks how to set clear boundaries, because that typically is one of the issues. If you have somebody that you truly love and care for is suffering from some type of addiction, oftentimes as caregivers we want to help. And really trying to set limits if you know that they're not using the
But
dollars.
There's also, I wouldn't know if I had a child or a spouse that was addicted, say, to alcohol. There is sort of contradictory advice out there. I believe the AA says you shouldn't change your way of life to accommodate them. In other words, don't go around hiding all the liquor bottles or banning liquor from the house, for example. Just practical advice. Should you ban liquor from the house? Or is it just going to make them hide it or... that kind of thing.
I think it depends on your relationship with the person. Let's say that you're fearful that your spouse is an alcoholic, or you feel that they're drinking too much, and you were to come in and ask, you know, what can you do in that situation? We likely would find out, well, what have you done before? What kind of conversation have you had?
Right.
What types of limits do you need to feel safe?
And I guess it's obviously it's different if it's a parent of a child
or a spouse.
A partner of someone. Yeah.
Right. You know, sometimes we do absolutely, we do work with adolescents as well. We do ask the parents to remove the alcohol from the home if there is alcohol.
Sure.
Because children.
Yeah, with children that would be appropriate, I think. Yeah.
You know, you don't certainly want them drinking in your home. Right. If you know they have a problem, it's best to sanitize the area so that it can't happen there. But with spouses, it really depends on, you know, is this person really seeking treatment? I mean, does your spouse really want to quit, or do you want them to quit?
Oh, yeah, motivation.
Yes, motivation makes a big difference as to what your next step is going to be.
What kind of statistics do you have for recovery?
I think that... as far as statistics for recovery, like how many people go through treatment and stay sober or stay gambling free, things like that, that is hard to grasp because addiction is a chronic illness, just like diabetes. There are certain cycles of addiction. Some people will go to treatment and will never see them again. They go, they are successful, they use all their tools, just like a diabetic. Mm-hmm. They control their diet, they exercise, they take their medications. With an addict, they need to do the same things. They have to really be careful about what types of people they're hanging out with. They have to be careful about what is their brain telling them. So when they're not feeling well, is the brain saying, you know, if you took a pill, if you just had a drink, just one, it'll help you, and being able to shut that down.
So, shut down the self-talk. That's
right,
damaging. Yeah.
Right. So I think that's one of those things.
So that's part of mindfulness, I suppose.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Correct. I have not seen statistics on success per se. What we can say is, at least with CFR, we have 94%, 93% of our clients that are discharged, they're satisfied with the services. Now, not all of our clients have the same goal. So not all of them say that we want abstinence as our goal. Some of them say, I want to cut down. Because we really use motivational enhancement therapy, we work with them where they're
at.
Well,
that's interesting, actually, for people to know that. In other words, you're not going to insist they become absolutely stone cold sober or never touch a drink in their life.
Because for some folks, I mean, that is just not going to work. Now, for others that really have stepped into the dependence or the addiction, that's probably going to be the choice they have to make.
Right, right.
But it is truly their choice. So our job is to educate, motivate, give them some skills they can leave with, and then they can decide. So some of the people will come back and say, you know what? You're right. I have actually crossed over into dependence. I'm ready to really work this time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's okay.
Now, I've got a question for Sally. Do you have any special events coming up that you'd like to notify our listeners about?
Well, every September is National Recovery Month. And CFR gets involved with this, and our biggest goal is to raise awareness about addiction as well as mental health disorders, that they're real, that treatment works, and that people do recover. So what we do, we have for a couple years now held a 5K run walk here in Ames. And
now, what's 5K? Sorry to be so ignorant.
Oh, 5K, 5 kilometer
run.
Yep, run walk.
Okay.
And it's really just an opportunity to bring people in the recovery community together, show our appreciation for those who are there to help, and really show our appreciation as well to the individuals who have turned their lives around and have learned how to manage their illness.
Tell them about the people who have come. We've had two walks and we've had people come back.
Yeah, we've had two events so far that have been along the same theme with the 5K. So the first year that we held it, we had an individual come. He had never walked this amount of length before. He came out. He said, I'll give it a try. CFR has helped me in my life. He came. He finished. And then he returned this past September at our second event.
Oh, terrific.
You know, it was very meaningful for him.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. We also had an individual who similarly participated our first year. And she had, at that point, just had, you know, a few months of sobriety underneath her belt. She came back the second year, and this has become for her kind of an annual recognition, you know, for her to look back on how far she has come. To have this opportunity to reach out to people in the recovery community, we're honored that we can be a part of their lives.
Okay, that's terrific. Thank you both for coming in today and talking to us about the services offered by Community and Family Resources. I've been talking with Michelle De La Riva and Sally Carnes from this organization. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Belinda Merritt, one of your hosts, together with my co-host, Kay Puttock. And now, Kay, I think we could say that in the next interview, we switch from human troubles to the troubles of humanity's best friend, the dog.
Yes, this is an interview with Mary LaHaye of Iowa Friends of Companion Animals. And she's gearing up for the various humane societies who are holding a lobby day coming up at the state capitol next Monday, February the 9th. I'm speaking to Mary LaHaye of Iowa Friends of Companion Animals and also Iowa Voters for Companion Animals. And this is particularly timely because there's a lobby day, a humane lobby day, coming up at the state legislature on February the 9th. And I just wanted to talk a bit about that first, Mary. Is it too late for people to sign up to come for the lobby day?
No, not at all. But we have two different options. There's a lunch option or just the option to go to the Capitol, just straight to the Capitol and lobby. You don't have to register to do that. We'll have an informational table on the first floor of the rotunda. Just show up. Sign up for the lunch is the deadline is passed.
Okay. In the rotunda itself?
On the north end of the rotunda, anywhere between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. on Monday the 9th.
You'll have a table set up there.
Yes, we're manning a table that we're co-sponsoring with Animal Rescue League.
And I believe this lobby day is associated with a new bill that's coming up, sponsored by your own senator there in Des Moines, Matt McCoy, and two other legislators, I believe. Do you know, can you talk a little bit about the provisions of that bill?
Sure. It hasn't been introduced yet, so since it hasn't been introduced, there's always a chance that things will change. But in a nutshell, what it does is ask for or provide for state oversight of USDA-licensed commercial dog breeders here in Iowa.
Right. Now, supposedly, there is always already a system of inspection. There's a state-level inspections, and there's also the federal inspections by the USDA. And I believe one of those works a lot better than others at the moment,
well,
the state system.
We're trying to get state oversight of the USDA licensees, who currently are only overseen by the USDA, and of the top four states in terms of numbers of dog breeders, and we are number two. Of those top four states, ours is the only state that does not have state oversight. And it's just that, you know, when we're talking about the welfare of animals, it makes sense to have closer in oversight. And so then we can also enforce our animal cruelty statute.
Right.
Because the USDA isn't beholden to uphold those, but we know for sure that there are some violations to our animal welfare laws going on in these facilities.
Yes. And some of my listeners might have heard I did a whole hour show on, well, responsible dog ownership, just focusing on where to get dogs. And we actually visited a large breeding facility here in Grundy Center, actually. Large breeding facilities are sometimes called puppy mills because they churn out puppies. Obviously, some of them are a lot better than others, but they all keep dogs in large, pretty large numbers. But I looked at the old bill, and I presume some of the provisions in the old bill, that Senate File 2254, will remain. It's basically trying to provide for fees and appropriations so that the taxpayer doesn't have to foot the bill for the inspections, for enhanced inspections, and also making meaningful penalties for when people violate the standards that are trying to be set. Now, there were a couple of provisions that really interested me in the old bill. For example, when someone wants to buy a dog from a breeder, they must be provided with a copy of the most recent inspection report, and they must keep copies of that, and so on. Also, provisions for fines, and so on. And also saying that dogs must have somewhere to lie down without lying on this wire mesh.
Yeah.
There's wire mesh and there's wire mesh. Some of it's tenderfoot flooring, which is a little easier on their paws, but it still can't be very comfortable to lie down on. And then this is very interesting. The breeder with more than 10 dogs shall only keep dogs in a primary enclosure that includes permanent unfettered access to an attached outdoor run. Now, the reason that was so interesting to me is I know there's some boarding facilities right here in Ames that would not pass that. This is places where people leave their dogs for daycare.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think provisions like that will remain in the new bill?
No, they absolutely are not. We are not including any of those standard changes at all.
So can you talk about what it does include?
It's primarily to give IDOLS the authority to, or actually the requirement.
IDOLS is?
Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewards. And it gives them the, it requires them to perform annual inspections of these USDA licensed facilities. And then it also increases the fees to cover the cost of those inspections. Now, the one provision that you did just now talk about where the breeder is required to provide the customer with a copy of their most recent inspection report. We did leave that in.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But nothing about access to an outdoor run?
No, I'm afraid that was quite a hot topic. We ran into horrendous opposition from the American Kennel Club, of all places.
Really?
From hobby breeders who were unwilling to listen to our explanations of what exactly that meant. And instead, they assumed the worst and, well, they were told the worst and they believed it and they wouldn't.
But it does say that this only applies to breeders with more than 10 dogs. Presumably, that wouldn't affect most hobby breeders.
No, it probably wouldn't, and they probably already do it anyway. It wasn't any one thing that was the hot button issue. It was the entire thing. I mean, down to the breeders with more than 3 adult intact dogs who sell puppies are supposed to be state licensed, and that has been law for years. But the hobby breeders were told by somebody that we were just making that part of the law new in the bill last year. And so that was probably one of the biggest things that set everybody off. And it's already law and it's still law and it will remain law. That's not changing.
So there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah, lots of fear mongering.
Now, you say that Iowa is the second worst state or has the second most number of these large commercial dog breeding. Do you have any statistics then? What is the first state?
The first state is Missouri.
Okay.
And we have the second largest number of USDA licensed dog breeding facilities. Those tend to be large operations with large numbers of dogs. We've got one breeder that keeps over 1,500 dogs. We've got a few that have over 400. We have many with more than 100. So these are the folks who are producing puppies that go into the pet trade where they end up in pet stores all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a very prominent poster on the side of our local buses here in Ames, the Sci-Ride buses. Pets in the store, get out the door.
Yeah.
And there is a pet store here that sells small dogs from one of the breeder I in fact mentioned. I did, when I was talking to him, he doesn't sell all his dogs in the pet store. Most of them, the buyers come and visit his facility and play with the dogs before they're ready to be taken home. There's just certain dogs, which are slightly different breed, that he sells in pet stores. And I said, why is that? And these were his words, and I quote, it's a cheap dog. You know.
I wonder if the customers are allowed to see the parents of those dogs when they come to visit and play with those puppies.
The experience that we had was similar to the experience that Mindy Callison of Bailing Out Benji had. You're allowed to see his, like, show kennels, but he was reluctant to show where he had a lot of dogs. It's inside a big barn, and then there's and she never got to see in there except by accident, as it were. It happened to be, the big barn doors happened to be open. And she just said there were hundreds of dogs in there. When I first arrived, I could hear all the dogs barking in there, and I asked to see. He said no, and I recorded all these times he was saying no. He said no 3 times. Finally, I talked him into letting. I said, well, you know, people are going to assume the worst if you don't let us see inside there.
Right.
And he did let us see, and it really was no different from the. It was just the number of dogs there. It was properly heated and cooled. He showed us where that happened. The dogs did have, in a sense, an outdoor run. They had area that was not the run, and then they could come out. But the whole thing was inside a barn. When we arrived, he had puppies playing on the grass. And I said, do the adult dogs ever get out? And he said, oh, sure. But later when I pinned him down and tried to say, well, you know, how many people do you have helping you, and how often do these dogs get out? It became clear that they don't get out much. And, of course, dogs for thousands of years, they have... I mean, that's what a domestic dog is. It's an animal that for thousands of years has been living in association with human beings.
Yes.
And they need that. They need that companionship. Would you like to tell people about your website and remind them again about the Lobby Day and where they should go?
Yes, the website is iafriends.org. And Lobby Day is Monday, February 9th from 11 to 3 up at the Capitol. Come to the first floor rotunda. We'll give you everything you need to effectively lobby your legislator in support of a bill to help these dogs.
And do you have a humane lobby day every year?
Yes, sometime between January and April.
So
we have a Facebook page too.
Mm-hmm.
Iowa Voters for Companion Animals.
Right.
A Facebook page. And so, and on our website, if you go to the Take Action tab and sign up for our e-newsletters, you'll get forewarning of all of these events.
Yeah, because I was looking at the Lobby Day stuff on your website, and it really looks like fun to go to the whole thing and the lunch and everything if you can sign up for that in time. So people should be aware of that and look out for the next year. So if they didn't get signed up for the whole thing, well, that's terrific. So you're getting more and more support.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you for taking care of humankind's best friend, the dog. I've been talking to Mary LaHaye of Iowa Friends of Companion Animals and Iowa Voters for Companion Animals about the Lobby Day on February the 9th. Well, Belinda, now it's time for your roundup of the local music scene.
Yes, for tonight, Friday, February 6th, Brother Bailey will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler, from 8 p.m. until 1 o'clock a.m. Joe Hertier and the Rainbow Seekers will be at the maintenance shop at the Memorial Union, ISU, at 9 o'clock p.m. Damon Dotson will be at Westtown Pub, 4518 Mortenson Road. Jade Reed, Mustafa Abdik, Sean Shady, and Justin Time will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. Tomorrow, Saturday, February 7th, John Mark Nelson will be at the maintenance shop at the Memorial Union, ISU, at 9 o'clock p.m. The Vinyl Vagabonds will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main. And Richard Arndt will be at Crossroads Tavern, 1709 Giddings, Cali.
That's it for Local Talk. We've been your hosts for today, Kay Puttock and Belinda Merritt.
Today we spoke with Commander Jason Tuttle of the Ames Police, Michelle De La Riva and Sally Carnes of Community and Family Resources, and also with Mary LaHaye of Iowa Voters for Companion Animals.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin'. by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Our engineer today is Rebecca Brown. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron.
KHOI is now streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you can also find archives of KHOI's shows. Please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it at all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Mm-hmm.